From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, reaction to a new MSU study finding Michigan has the biggest decline in school funding in the nation.
You know, it's unrealistic to say, well, we just needed more money. Where do you get it when you had tough economic times?
The long history of sexual assaults of African American women.
Back to when we were enslaved people in this country, Black women had no dominion over their bodies. They cannot decide about who to say yes to, if they could say yes at all.
Why the honeymoon is over between the White House and auto companies.
Business abhors uncertainty, and this administration continues to kind of churn and stir the pot in ways that they just don't know what direction they're going to go next.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new Michigan State University study finds our state has the largest school funding decline in the nation, down 30% from 2002 to 2015. Let's get some reaction now as we welcome Republican Senator Wayne Schmidt of Traverse City. He's the chair of the K-12 and Michigan Department of Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Senator, this MSU report finds Michigan dead last in the country in school funding growth. How did you feel about that?
Well, initially, you know, looking at the news reports, certainly concerned. Just downloaded yesterday the report, starting to go through with it and find, you know, where we can improve things. You know, I don't think that it completely told the whole story. There's a lot of challenges Michigan has faced following Proposal A, you know, in terms of the economy, student counts, you know, but overall, we should definitely be putting more money into education.
Well, you know, as you say, there's a story here in this quarter century since Michigan voters turned control of K-12 funding over to the state when they said yes to Proposal A. So here we are at the end, you know, 25 years later, dead last in education revenue growth. Why has education funding declined? What are the main reasons?
Well, when you start to look at it, there's a number of different things. You know, one, when we talk about education funding and decline, are we talking, when we're talking inflationary increases, there's different ways to judge that, you know, consumer price index versus the state and federal government, ways that you count. That's one thing that can adjust. Two, we saw some of the greatest declines in property values, in income, in jobs that no other state in the country faced. And K-12 education has more different funding sources than just about any other government agency or any function that we do. And when all of them were going down, that creates the perfect storm. And that's been one of the biggest challenges. But, you know, we have currently record funding levels now. And we have fewer students than we've ever had, too. So that's also, you know, you kind of have to wonder.
The thing that, as I kind of look through that report, and the authors are very very focused on how the state legislature has put so much energy and attention into accountability. And the MSU report flatly said, Lansing's done that without ever asking, and I'll quote here, how much it costs to educate a student to meet those standards or how that cost differs for special needs students.
Well, yeah, that's been a challenge. Special needs students, clearly they have been more expensive. When you look at race to the top legislation that occurred in the late 2000s, the fact that taxpayers want more accountability, yeah, there was pressure on us to do that. And it hasn't always been the best. But
it seems that the funding for schools to reach those measures wasn't kind of part of the education strategy in Lansing in this last quarter century.
Well, I think that it was. But when you had the double-dip recession, the recession in the early 2000s, and then the late 2000s, you know, and that included cuts in federal funding, too. And so, you know, I think that both Governor Granholm and Governor Snyder faced tough economic headwinds, which has made it tough to combat that, but people still wanted accountability. But when you look at it, we're still spending record amounts of money on education. Part of it is that we're also making sure that teacher commitments that we have for retirees are being met, and that takes up a lot of money. So we're trying, and You know, the locals still have the ability for sinking funds, for capital outlay, things like that. But, you know, Michigan's economy is finally coming back.
Because it's been, we've been out of that recession.
Yeah, right.
We are putting money in, but we're seeing test scores from students all around the state drop. You know,
right.
On so many different metrics, and you know them. I won't run through them all. But, you know, particularly the National Assessment of Education Progress, that's the nation's report card when we have kids, Michigan kids now at the bottom. So we've cut school funding and school performance is down.
Well, we haven't cut school funding. We've put more money in. You know, depending on how this report just strictly looks at what the inflationary increases are, that's a challenge right there. But we're continuing to put more money in. You know, there are other factors, too, that enter into school performance or student performance particularly that, you know, are beyond our control. And I am, one, I would definitely like to put more money into education. I'll be upfront about that.
Mm-hmm.
If the state budget can handle it, if the economy can handle it, if the taxpayers are able to handle it, then fine, of course, put more money into education. But when you have families that, because of the economy, have moved around, have lost jobs, family stresses, that impacts student performance too. And that's been a challenge. And I think, hopefully, we're seeing the bottoming out coming off of some tough economic times, that those test scores will come back up, that families are feeling more secure, that we're attracting more talent to Michigan, that there's more investment being made, property values are going up. That's, I hope, is going to make a difference.
Senator Schmidt, the MSU report calls for an increase in school funding of $3.6 billion a year. Author David Anson notes Michigan was spending that much more on education in 2007 when adjusted for inflation. That call of $3.6 billion a year, 20% increase, is that at all possible?
I would say initially no.
Why?
I mean, because, what are the taxpayers? Are they willing to do that too? Two, I don't know if it's completely an issue of funding. I'm not saying not to put more money in. You know, is it $3.6 billion? Do the authors guarantee that's going to have, you know, make 100% success? No, they're not saying that. More money into education, I think, can be beneficial, but it's not the end-all, be-all. I think one of the areas that we're looking at with increased school funding are nurses, counselors, and social workers. So I think it's also changing some of the support services that we offer or reinstating those support services. So money does play a factor, but I think it's also making sure that we're taking away some of the additional burdens that we've put on teachers and allowing them to do what they do best, which is teach.
Thinking of as we talk about this study and what it found and the recommendations, let me ask you, as a member of the legislature, how do you think Lansing can do better for Michigan schools and even more to the point, Michigan kids?
The best thing we can do is make this a place where families want to live here in Michigan. One of the problems that we're facing in northern Michigan is declining enrollment. So I think to have better schools, you need the families to be here, to be engaged. And allowing them to be engaged means they need to have good jobs and feel confident in that they're, you know, in the community they've chose to live in. And so I think it's a getting out of the way in terms of allowing Michigan's economy to grow, which in turn increases revenue, which we can put into schools. So I think that's the best way we can do that. If mom and dad are feeling good about what's happening and the revenues are coming into the state, that's going to directly impact how the students do, both in terms of their physical plant, where they're going to school, and in terms of how they're feeling and their ability to learn. But now we're starting to see more money going into education. So I'm hoping that, and the economy is getting better, so I'm hoping we're going to pull out of this and go forward. You know, I think streamlining some of the bureaucracy for schools, I do agree. I think we are over-testing. We have not hit the right spot in terms of being able to gauge student performance and their ability to learn versus, you know, all these tests that we do, MSTEP and all of that. I think that has been, we have been a little herky-jerky in that sense. And that's why I've been working with my superintendents, school board members, teachers back home in the district, saying what works.
Professor David Arsen from Michigan State, the professor of education policy, was the lead author. And I just want to kind of end with your thoughts on something he wrote in this study, and I'm going to quote him. Mm-hmm. Michigan has tried to improve schools on the cheap, focusing on more accountability and school choice. To make those policies effective, they have to be matched with adequate funding. We have been kidding ourselves to think we can move forward while cutting funding for schools. What are your thoughts?
Well, one, I think that some of the bureaucracy that we have added to testing, that's correct. We need to make sure we find the best test, the most easily administered test, and one that gives real-time feedback as to how our students are performing or where they need help. That would be a great step. Two, we have not been cutting funding. We've been putting more money in. That's clearly not the case. Now, it might not always be at the rate of inflation or whatever metric they're using, but we are continuing to put more money in. And, you know, it's unrealistic to say, well, we just needed more money. Where do you get it when you had tough economic times? You know, just to say, oh, we just needed more money, well, that's just not possible. But we're headed in the right direction. Governor Snyder's commitment to that was there, but also Governor Whitmer. I know she is working for the schools, so I'm going to work with the governor and her administration, work with my colleagues, Senator Tice, on education policy, my colleagues in the House, and we'll continue to do our best to put more money into education and make it easier for teachers to teach and a good place for students to learn and places parents want to live. You know, if it was as simple as giving $3.6 billion, you know, other states that are supposedly spending more money than us would obviously be perfect places and not have problems. But while Michigan might be lacking, according to this study, it's not saying that other states aren't having problems and that money is just simply the answer.
Senator Wayne Schmidt of Traverse City, chair of the K-12 and Michigan Department of Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Senator, thank you so much.
Great to be on Stateside. Thank you.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Eudora Welty wrote, "Making reality real is art's responsibility." And that's what artist David Updike is doing with his new work, This Land. It's made of hundreds of vintage postcards, which he then painted over to show us the environmental chaos that could await generations in the not-too-distant future. Updike's work will be displayed beginning tomorrow at the University of Michigan's Institute for Humanities Gallery. He's the 2019 Ephraimson Emerging Artist in Residence at the University of Michigan. David Updike, you've gotten a lot of national coverage for this wall piece, This Land. Would you describe it for us?
Okay. Essentially what I did was I tried to assemble a large wall-filling landscape out of individual postcards. They're all from the early 20th century because of the way the printing works and how that sort of evokes this lovely nostalgia for the way America was and the promise of the future that used to be embodied in there. Anyway, the idea is that they're all stitched together to sort of create cityscapes and lakes and rivers and mountains and streams and things like that. And then at the bottom, the whole original grid that you can imagine was there before is starting to crumble.
Yes.
And then into the individual cards, sometimes spanning across from one card to the next, are lots of natural disasters, tornadoes, fires, floods. And then more fun for me, actually, after I set everything on fire and started breaking things, was to think about how people would react to the situation, how they're reacting now, taking advantage of it, trying to sell new real estate based on new coastline or predicting the end of the world, building an ark
building an ark. Yeah. I saw the building the ark. Yeah, yeah. So it's people's response to these things that are happening that are terribly chaotic. And I love the way Lawrence Wechsler in the New York Times, when he did his review of this work, he said, you know, pointed out the closer you look at these postcards, the more it just draws you in because you've painted such sly things over these cards. And so I'm interested in how you did this. You collected, what, 528 vintage postcards?
Well, I think I've got a couple thousand by now. I mean,
collected more than that.
Yes.
So how did you go about organizing and creating the mosaic? Did that come first? And I know this took you, what, over a year?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, what I'd been doing was working with individual cards, doing little one-off lovely little sort of political cartoon type things with them. And I just started to feel like I wanted to put more of them together. And the difficulty, not to get too wonky about it, is dealing with horizon line. You start stacking them vertically, and all of a sudden you're just not looking at a unified picture. You're looking at a series of horizons. So I guess in reality it started with that valley with the sunset in the middle of it, finding these strange diagonals of postcards of mountainsides and stuff like that. And then that was sort of the anchor, I guess, the visual anchor. And then the rest of it was sort of trying to get the thing to sort of hold together visually. Mm. And then it changed 10, 20 times. I mean, I'd have friends come over and they'd say, oh, this is great. I'm not really sure I understand what's happening over here.
Okay.
And they leave and I just sort of, you know, and then tear the whole thing apart and start over, which was extremely valuable. I can't thank them enough for sort of pushing me through that kind of thing.
Because as you first look at this, there's this V-shaped valley and one may think, oh, the sun is rising. Actually, probably not. We probably would say now, knowing what, as you look more closely, the sun is setting. What are the dimensions?
It's 16 foot six wide. And about 8 feet tall.
Wow, that is something. I guess I'm wondering, how do you want art like this land to help us move collectively in a better direction, one that would keep this environmental chaos from being visited on our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren?
Well, I mean, I'm just a visual artist, okay? I'm working within a sort of constrained kind of context usually, and I would love for this thing to sort of escape, you know, the northeastern New York kind of area and like come to places like this where people would have more of a chance to see it a storefront somewhere downtown where people can walk up to it and just sort of wondering what on earth is going on. I mean, the idea is the way I selected the postcards is to try and cover as much ground as possible instead of always sort of thinking about targeting Washington, you know, supposed leaders of everything. In the end, everyone has to take this seriously and pay attention to it in order for anything to really happen. It's not about like giving the president a hard time or giving the Congress a hard time.
Or the EPA or anybody.
Yeah. We are the ones who have to sort of like figure out what we're supposed to do.
You know, it reminds me as I went to your website, because we should note that you put it up at davidupdyke.com, and the viewer can go and zoom in, zoom out, and really kind of dive in and explore this. And when I did that, for some reason, maybe I'm all wet here, but it reminds me of what Dickens wrote in A Christmas Carol with the ghost of Christmas future, and he's forcing Scrooge to look at his own grave. And allow me here. Here's the quote. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they the shadows of the things that may be only? Still, the ghost pointed downward to the grave by which it stood. Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if persevered, they must lead, said Scrooge. Are you, in essence, kind of serving as the ghost of the future?
Maybe. I mean, in a way, for me, the cards being from the early 20th century, already within the America that was being built, was this present moment. We've been at this way of living and treating the world and sort of consuming resources and feeling like progress is what matters. And we've got enough of the lovely nature set aside in special places.
In our special parks.
Everything fine. Yeah. And it's like the future and the past and the present are this, unfortunately, seeming sort of straight line in a way, which I'm hoping that we can bend, I guess.
Well, that's it. Are they the shadows of things that will be
right,
or things that may be only? And do you believe in your heart we can reverse the course of this climate change?
I really don't know. Yeah. I try and be hopeful about it because I've got two kids. I mean, everybody has, you know, their worries and dreams about the future, and I certainly hope we can figure this all out and sort of take it more seriously.
And you do show people building an ark.
Yes. Well, is that a sensible government sprung in this particular piece?
Yes.
It's sort of packaged as either a government project that has funding, or it's a private enterprise, or it's a sort of deep felt religious response. Mm-hmm. It's one. Okay. It's many of several things. It's either foolish, or it's smart, or it's necessary.
You're the 2019 Ephraimson Emerging Artist in Residence at the University of Michigan, which means what? What will you be doing as part of that?
Well, I mean, it's primarily setting up the work, and I've been sort of making – I bought a bunch of Michigan postcards to sort of play around with, so I've been like working with those, and I'm meeting with some students and things like that and doing a little bit of research and stuff like that while I'm here.
And does the fact that you're working with these student artists at U of M, is it giving you a chance to perhaps – you know, open their minds, influence
yeah,
them?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, I'm certainly not going to tell people what to think. Yeah, maybe a way to think about this is we're doing a little panel discussion on Friday before the show, and it's all about whether artists, visual artists, writers, musicians should be thinking about political goals or trying to change the world in a way, or whether we should not do that and just do lovely things that make people feel better, or whether we should just put down our pens, typewriters, and inks and just run for office.
Mm. And from looking at this land, we know where you stand on this. That
yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, I have my skill set and what I'm good at.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying that it would be a bad thing for me to like spend more time at city council meetings and things like that, but it's just not quite the way my personality functions. I think I do better in the studio, but we'll see.
Well, it's a fascinating work, and the new wall piece by David Updike, This Land, is part of the exhibition that's opening tomorrow, and it will run through February 27th at the University of Michigan's Institute for the Humanities. And again, if you can't make that, I remind you, you can go to David's website, davidupdike.com, and you can explore This Land. It's right there. Zoom in, zoom out, scope all around, and you will find so many layers of this fascinating and challenging piece. David Updike, it was great to meet you, and we want to thank you so much for being here to share your work with us.
Thank you very much.
Radon is a naturally occurring radioactive gas that's found in soil and rocks. Outside, the gas just disperses into the atmosphere. But inside a building, it's a different story. The gas can get into basements through cracks in the foundation, plumbing openings, concrete, and then it gets trapped, and that can pose a major health risk. Since January is Radon Action Month, we thought that's a good time to talk about radon, how to test for it, what to do if it's in your house. For that, we welcome Angela Parsons, the Environmental Health Education Coordinator for Washtenaw County. Angela, just what are the health risks of having radon in the home?
Well, the main concern with radon is through its inhalation, so in breathing it in. Unfortunately, over time, breathing in this radioactive material can lead to the development of lung cancer. And radon is associated with about 21,000 cases of lung cancer in the United States each year.
Angela, do we have any idea how much radon you would need to be exposed to and over how long a period before you know, you really are courting that risk of lung cancer?
The Environmental Protection Agency, they establish their risk estimates based on a lifetime of exposure. So again, this is a long-term concern and a long-term risk. It's not like other gases like carbon monoxide where we can go to sleep at night and not wake up in the morning. It's something where over a long period of time, essentially a lifetime, it can increase your individual risk of lung cancer. And since it is a controllable risk factor, it's something that we can take action on and do something about. So that's why we're encouraging folks to do that.
And that action would include testing, right?
Correct, yes. Unfortunately, because you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it, we have no idea if it's in our homes or in other buildings. So the only way to know if it's there is to do a test. There are really simple and inexpensive do-it-yourself tests that you can get from your local health department or from hardware or home improvement stores. And essentially what it is a little envelope or a little disc that you hang up in the lowest level of your home. And then after a few days, you take it down, drop it in the mail, and it goes to a laboratory, and they analyze it and send you the results.
So when we get the results back. At what point is it time to take action? What's the state action level for radon? And, you know, where do we go from an acceptable level to you need to take action?
Right. First off, there's no quote-unquote safe level of radon. Because it is a radioactive material, there's no level at which we say you're completely 100% safe. But the EPA has established an action level of 4.0 picocuries per liter of air. And essentially, that's a unit of measurement for radiation. That's not to say where if we have 4.1, oh my goodness, get the kids and the dog and get the heck out of the house. We got to abandon this property. We're not saying that, and we're not saying if you have 3.9, we never have to worry about radon again. That number is set as a guideline where we want folks to be reminded to take action.
All right. So I do the test. I get it back. I understand that, yes, I have radon in the house, and let's just say it's at that 4.0 picocuries per liter of air. So then what?
What we recommend folks do is to first do a confirmatory test, and then to mitigate the problem, we recommend having a professional company come in and install a radon mitigation system. And the type of system that's typically installed in Michigan is called a sub-slab depressurization system. And that's a fancy word for essentially installing a system of plastic white PVC piping attached to a fan. So typically what they do is come in and in the basement or lowest level of the house, they use an existing opening in the foundation, like if you have a sump pump in your basement, or if there's not an opening, they drill a hole through the concrete floor and then insert that plastic pipe into that hole and then route it out the side of the house and then put an elbow in it and run it up along the side of the house so that it exhausts above the roof. And then they attach the fan onto the pipe on the outside of the house. And that fan is tied into the electrical system, and it just runs continuously. And what that does is it kind of creates a suction to draw that soil gas that's rich with radon into that pipe and then shoots it out into the air above the home.
And gets it out of your basement.
Correct.
What does a system like that cost? Just ballpark.
Typically in Michigan, it's probably around $1,000 to have a system like that installed.
What if someone just does not have that $1,000? Is there anything they can do to kind of reduce the risk of radon exposure?
In some cases, caulking or sealing the basement and foundation, if there are really apparent cracks, or putting an airtight lid on that sump pump opening, sometimes that can help a little bit. Unfortunately, it's not as effective as installing a professionally installed radon mitigation system. Also, in some areas, I encourage folks to check with their county or local programs to see if there might be assistance available. For example, with a weatherization program, there are sometimes assistance available that could help with radon mitigation.
And Angela, is radon more likely to be found in some areas of Michigan than others?
Yes, it is. There are three different zones designated by the EPA. There's zone one, which is the most at risk, zone two, moderate risk, and then zone three, which is a little bit lower risk. And if you're looking at Michigan, the bottom swath of it is essentially a zone one area. For example, where I work in Washtenaw County, we're considered zone one. And that means that we have a higher likelihood of having homes with radon. And in Washtenaw, for example, about 40% of homes are estimated to have levels above that 4.0 threshold. So that's pretty significant.
And then does zone two and then three, mm-hmm. is that as you go north?
Right. So in the middle of the state, there's a swath of zone one counties, and then that kind of goes up to into the UP. And then as you get more into the western UP, it's closer to zone two. And so it's kind of a mix throughout Michigan. However, the one thing that I want to say is just because you live in a zone one county does not automatically mean that you're destined to have high levels of radon. Similarly, if you are looking at buying a home or living in a zone three county, that doesn't mean that, we don't have to worry about radon at all. It's not here.
Okay. Final quick question. How about renters? Who's responsible for the testing and mitigation?
With radon, it's always a tricky, touchy subject. Of course, landlords are supposed to provide safe sanitary conditions for their tenants. However, with radon, there aren't very many regulations or ordinances when it comes to radon as far as testing or mitigation. A lot of it is municipality dependent, and not many municipalities require testing or require mitigation. The one that I know of, for example, in my area is the city of Ann Arbor requires it, but no other local municipalities require it in Washtenaw County. And so I always encourage folks, if they're concerned about their residence where they're renting, they could do a test and then have a conversation with your landlord. Perhaps they aren't even aware of radon. Talk to the landlord, see if they're aware of it, see if they might be willing to take action. And then sometimes, you know, I'm always willing to have a conversation with those landlords as well, or the property managers, and just explain to them the risks and the benefits to them of ensuring that they're providing a safe and healthy environment for their tenants.
Angela Parsons, the Environmental Health Education Coordinator for Washtenaw County. Angela, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly has sparked tough conversations across the country about sexual abuse.
This is really not just about R. Kelly. He's a representation of a bigger problem in the African-American community, particularly.
African-American women and the Me Too movement. We'll hear that conversation in just 5 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Day 35 of the partial government shutdown. Some 800,000 government workers are going to miss another paycheck tomorrow. And that's not counting many, many more contractors who are not only missing paychecks, they're not getting back pay. Economists warn of dire consequences the longer this drags on. And for business like auto companies, the uncertainty is the last thing they want. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here. And you write in today's column, I'm going to quote you, "The honeymoon between Detroit and the White House is long since over." Count the reasons for us, Daniel.
Oh, good Lord. Tariffs, trade tension, I think, gyrating stock market, the shutdown you mentioned, even the president's own economists are saying that if this continues to the end of the first quarter, the growth rate could go to zero. Think about that for a second. I mean, you could just tell when you're at the auto show with auto execs last week, the kind of quiet anxiety that they had about the uncertainty. Business abhors absurdity, and this administration continues to kind of churn and stir the pot in ways that they just don't know what direction they're going to go next.
Well, and as you write, Donald Trump is learning that publicly traded companies and their executive teams don't work for him, which has to be contributing to the end of this whatever kind of honeymoon was there.
I mean, take General Motors, for example. I mean, early in the administration, the president was, you know, very solicitous of Mary Barra, the CEO, always insisted that she sit next to him when they would have meetings in the Roosevelt Room. Fast forward now to November, right after Thanksgiving, when they come out and announce General Motors that they're going to be certainly idling and likely closing 4 plants in the United States and 1 in Canada. The president goes into a swivet and essentially demands that they bring new product and put it into Lordstown in Northeast Ohio as one example. And Mary Barra politely says the same thing to the president and the White House that she said to Congress and others. Thank you, but no. We're not going to do that. And, you know, these companies are going to continue to make decisions that are going to benefit them and their shareholders. And they really are not interested in making decisions that are going to make score political points for the president in the industrial Midwest.
And you talked to Bill Ford. You had quite a conversation during the show. And what did he have to say about it?
Well, he also lamented the lack of civility coming from Washington, and without naming names, but I think we all kind of know where that was headed, and commented on the fact that nothing is getting done. And I mean, and if you look at this just from a policy perspective, I mean, look at this, to borrow the phrase used by Debbie Dingell, the representative from Dearborn, this pissing match between Nancy Pelosi and the President of the United States over the State of the Union. is a classic example. So, I mean, I don't think there's any question that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, is giving as good as she gets from the president. In some cases, probably giving more than he's pushing back.
And he blinked. He says, all right, I won't give the State of the Union
address. Yeah, he did. And I think that that dynamic, which is all fun and well to watch as kind of political sport, but nothing's getting done. And if you are trying to make multi-billion dollar decisions, I mean, just today, Ford Motor Company announced, or yesterday, their numbers, and tariffs and a lot of the tension are costing their shareholders real money and measured in the billions in terms of things they're having to contend with. Steel and aluminum prices, the highest cost steel in the world is in the United States. And so if you're Ford Motor Company and you're sourcing all of your steel principally from American producers, think about the hit you're taking. You're paying more than you would pay anywhere else in the world. And that is because of the tariffs that have been enacted by President Trump's administration.
Trying times. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
The six-part Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly exploded in this country, and it's soon to be aired overseas. It explores decades of allegations against R&B singer R. Kelly, with more than 50 interviews with women alleging they were sexually, physically, and emotionally abused by R. Kelly.
This man is a monster. That's what he is.
I'm going to call the police and tell them you kidnapped my sister.
This can't keep going on.
You need to see the effects of your behavior.
Now, we should note, as you've probably heard from news coverage, R. Kelly denies all accusations. But all of this has raised more awareness of sexual abuse, sexual harassment in the African-American community. And that is Kalima Johnson's life work. She is a sexual assault survivor, and she is the founder and executive director of the Sasha Center in Detroit. Sasha stands for Sexual Assault Services for Holistic Healing and Awareness. Kalima Johnson is with us now via Skype. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much, Cindy. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about the work.
So, Kalima, as all of this buzz has gone on as this Lifetime documentary series, Surviving R. Kelly, aired, what do you make of all of that that's happening around this series?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I found the Surviving R. Kelly series profound. It was a very good job on behalf of Dream Hampton and all the folks that she worked with to produce the Lifetime series. It was a trigger for the African-American community for sure, and it's causing a lot of conversation around a plethora of things, including who's to blame, who should pay for this, who did he fool, who did he not fool, whose fault is it, victim blaming, rape culture, racism, oppression, what happens in the African-American community should stay in the African-American community. A whole lot of things have come out. I think it's a good thing. We just need to take our time. The whole community needs to take a deep breath and let's begin to really unpack all of the issues that are related to what they saw, what they experienced, and what we've been fooled to believe. I mean, because overall, this is really not just about R. Kelly. He's a representation of a bigger problem in the African-American community, particularly. And as I talk about this, I am going to be talking about it from a perspective of being African-American and of this community, but I am not painting a broad brush because we are very different in all kinds of ways. But there are certain themes that we need to really actually talk about.
And talking about the community and moving kind of away from the documentary and into everyday life and what statistics tell us, studies are finding for every African-American woman who reports being sexually assaulted, there are 15 who do not. And then a Brandeis University study found in one locality, prosecutors brought charges in 75% of the claims made by white women, but only 34% of claims made by African-American women are prosecuted. So my question is, Kalima, what is going on here? Why aren't women reporting and why aren't prosecutors prosecuting?
Okay, so I think that's a very good question, and thank you for framing that around two research studies, because it's really important that people understand why this is. So one of the reasons, and I wrote the model, The Triangulation of Black Women and Rape, is that in this country, if I was to go all the way back to when we were enslaved people in this country,
Black women had no dominion over their bodies. They could not decide about who to say yes to, if they could say yes at all. And there was a lot of sexual assault of Black women in this country with no punishment. Like if you go down to the lynching museum in Alabama now, you'll see that all these lynching memorials are about the rape of white women by Black men primarily. But what we know for sure is that no white or Black man was lynched for the rape of a Black woman in this country. It hasn't been marked or assigned or anything. And so we know that Black women's bodies have never been valued to that degree. And so because of that, we also have on top of that the dynamic of the criminal justice system and how the criminal justice system has treated African-American men particularly. And so we know that there's a lot of unfair, biased treatment of Black men, murdering of Black men. And so you have Black women who will participate in group that will say, I'm not going to the police because I want him corrected. I don't want him murdered. Or I don't trust the criminal justice system because they're going to blame me for what I did, because they truly believe that we don't have dominion over our bodies. And they truly believe these negative stereotypes about Black women being easy, being fast, being Jezebels, being prostitutes, or enjoying sex more than everybody else. You know, they make us like we're objects and not human beings with breathing, living cells and bodies, heart and blood. So the problem here is systemic in that the way this country has seen and treated Black women has reflected on the way in which Black women seek and get help. Now, I'm gonna be honest with you. Black women have been healing from sexual abuse, assault, and trauma for many years, but they've been doing it in silos and in silence. They have not been doing it in the open public. And I think what this film does and what Sasha Center does particularly is bring attention to how we've been healing, why we've been healing in the ways that we have been healing, and how we can help others understand that our healing is a little different. Because as you already stated, there's a difference in terms of justice, and there's a difference in terms of the type of ways we're getting treated. And we can look at that on all levels, like how we're being treated in the medical system, the educational systems, as well as religious systems, how we're being treated. A lot of times we're expected to be silent. We're expected to take on this heavy weight and this heavy burden of being extra super strong and super women. They're expecting all these things from us. And that puts us at risk of being sexually assaulted, one, but it also puts us at risk from not being able to share that we're in trouble and to ask for that help that we need. So it's layered. It's multi-layered.
Kelly Mead, when you think about how the accusations against Harvey Weinstein started to really form a watershed moment in recognizing the way that a powerful man can force himself on a woman, and it launched the hashtag MeToo movement. Has that movement included Black women in their experiences, in your view?
Yes and no. Okay, so the Me Too movement actually started with Tarana Burke, who was an African-American woman who was putting this stuff out on MySpace. And when Alyssa Milano found out that that was the case, she actually put out a tweet immediately acknowledging Tarana. And then the next thing you know, Tarana was a part of some of those public conversations around the issue of Me Too. Hmm. I definitely feel like the Me Too movement in some ways was being co-opted. And that happens a lot in our movements, which is why I'm asking every person who can listen to this interview to protect the Triangulation of Black Women model with their whole selves and their whole souls, because I do not want anybody taking credit for the work that me and my crew and my people from the Sasha Center put together from our lived experiences. A lot of people wish that my model was a dissertation, but it's not. It's a community model. It's a community model because we got direct stories and experiences from people with a little bit of help from doing some research as well, which is extremely important. But what I'm saying to you is that this whole movement, it should be identified for everybody, but clearly it's not for everybody. When we're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace, and then we're talking about sexual assault and rape, those are kind of two different things.
They are.
And you have to think about how we all have experienced these things. But there has never been a movement, and as Angela Davis put it so keenly in one of her statements and one of her speeches, that Black women still continue to be sorely in need of an anti-rape movement, because we're being treated like the doormat of all these other issues. Like, they don't even see us. It's just, we're just inconsequential. We're invisible. And I think that we need to have more visibility. And I think that the Me Too movement could serve as more visibility, but it's an and in both double-edged sword. Mm. You know, when we're running group and we have a survivor that comes in the room and says, I can't even get my mind straight because my mom just posted Me Too and she knows I've been raped. And now I didn't find out she got raped just by watching the hashtag on our Facebook page. And we never talked about it. Huh. That's kind of the dynamic that also is happening in this whole movement, where people are feeling free to hashtag and break the silence and let the world know. But what are you doing beyond that? And that's why Sasha Center is here. We're here to help people process, integrate, use, and gain valuable tools and share the tools that they already have for healing. Because what we know is that you're not going to ever forget that you were sexually assaulted. And for those of you who are listening out there in the world, it's not your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. This is going to be a part of you for the rest of your life. You just got to make sure that this trauma doesn't dictate everything in your life and that you can be and become the best person that you can be in spite of all of the racism, in spite of the oppression, in spite of the victim blaming, in spite of rape culture that exists, that impacts us all. But it's a little extra for women of color. And it's even a little bit more extra for African-American women.
Kalima, briefly explain, what is the triangulation of Black women and rape?
It's a model that explains why it's difficult for Black women to seek services, how it's difficult for services to make their programs culturally relevant and specific for Black women, and why it's difficult for funders to find relevant ways and more creative ways in helping us fund the work. That's really what the triangulation of Black women and rape is. It's a twofold mirror for people to see the behaviors that come from outside our community, but also the behaviors that come from inside our community that has to be addressed in order for Black women to receive and get the best services possible.
I'm talking with Kalima Johnson, who's founder and executive director of the Sasha Center in Detroit, Sexual Assault Services for Holistic Healing and Awareness, as we talk about the challenges of sexual assault and sexual harassment in the Black community. Chance the Rapper, Kalima, has been saying he now regrets collaborating with R. Kelly. Here's a quick clip from an interview with Cassius that he did earlier this month.
Maybe I didn't care because I didn't value the accuser's stories, like, because they were Black women.
I didn't value the accuser's stories because they were Black women. What do you want to say about that statement?
It's heartbreaking. It's sad. And it's true. A lot of people will say that they don't value our stories and they don't believe us. But part of the reason why they don't value our stories and they don't believe us is because we have been treated in this country as subhuman by a lot of folk. And it's hard to come to terms with understanding the truth of the matter and the trauma of the matter when you think that this person is subhuman, or when you think that this person asked for it, or when you think this person is nothing but, something that's lesser valued. Like, for instance, you have Black women like myself who are navigating the world every day as a Black woman doing great things. And yet and still, there'll be somebody who might ask me to show them how to twerk. I don't know how to twerk, but you assume I do because that's all you've ever seen of us. And I'm not trying to diss women that twerk, because somehow those dances in Africa aren't twerking. But because of the transatlantic slave trade and because of what has happened to us since we've been in this country, it has become sexualized. And so Black women have been sexualized, and we are sexualized from very early. The moment we start developing, even before we start developing, we're treated as if we're older. We're treated as if we're more sexual. And if we treat you that way, then that gives us permission to continue to negate you. And so the fact that he said that was heartbreaking, but it's also true. And it's also something that we really have to address in our communities, inside and outside of our communities. Because if you didn't value our story, that means you didn't value us as human beings.
And that, of course, goes right to the heart of the work that you do at the Sasha Center in Detroit. And we should remind everybody, you can learn a lot more about all of the services and their work by going to the website, which is sashacenter.org, sashacenter.org. Kalima, what has your work meant for you in healing from your sexual assault?
Oh, thank you for saying that and asking me that. It has meant the world. I believe that Sasha Center and its creation and the work that we do is a huge part of my ongoing healing and integration. A lot of people feel like you have to be totally healed in order to do this work, but it ebbs and it flows. For me, being able to create safe spaces for women of color to be able to tell their stories, an untold story, like Maya Angelou says, is just torture if you can't tell it. So, and that's not exactly what she said, but the bottom line is the Sasha Center was created to provide safe space for African American women to finally not just share their stories of trauma, but to be able to share their stories of triumph and how they have recovered and how they have integrated these experiences and how they have lived in spaces where they identify as healed or not. You know, it's just giving them the opportunity. A lot of times, you know, funding sources ask us to identify what did they do as a result of coming to group. And I say, why don't we celebrate the fact that they just were even able to come to group? Because Black women have been ostracized and silenced for so long, to just give them credit for showing up is the first step we need to take. And it has meant the world to me. It has meant that I know that once I take my last breath, that I have left a legacy. I have left something for us to talk about. I have left just a little bit more of an opportunity for us to heal and integrate. I don't take it for granted any day. And I've learned so much from survivors. I've learned so much, and our facilitators are amazing. And women who have shared their stories for the first time. We'll have women in intergenerational groups that are sharing for the first time at 17 and sharing for the first time at 70. And they all matter. They all matter.
Kalima Johnson, founder, executive director of the Sasha Center in Detroit. Again, the website is sashacenter.org. Kalima, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much, Cindy, for the opportunity.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.